Pino Luongo began working in the food industry in 1980 after he immigrated to the United States from Tuscany. And in 1983, he opened Il Cantinori, the first of a number of successful restaurants he would go on to establish. He's written something of a tell-all memoir of his experiences called Dirty Dishes, a restaurateur's story of passion, pain, and pasta. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased to welcome Pino Luongo back to the show. Hi.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
For the first time since 1988, you have only one restaurant to run. Did that give you extra time to write this memoir?
I guess so. Yes, it gave me plenty of time to concentrate on this project because at the beginning it was a project that I was concerned to put in place because I know that due to the fact that I really deal with my business on a very personal basis, I don't view the restaurant business as just a business. It's something that involves everything about me, my emotion, my feelings. It's my way of life. And because fundamentally I love to hang out with customers, people, I really do love people. And more importantly, I do love to provide them food.
Well, one of the chapters in the book is called The Restaurant Junkie. Is that how you would describe yourself? Or is that the way your friends and family would describe you?
No, that was a point of my life that basically I was totally inebriated by corporate America and my successes at the time. And I was basically offered an opportunity to do larger and more things. My instinct when I was going to sleep at night those days was telling me every day, don't do it, don't do it. You are fundamentally an entrepreneur. And eventually my instinct prevailed because it was right. I did the wrong thing.
Well, there are some restaurateurs who have expanded into other cities, first Las Vegas, then Miami, and they go elsewhere. They usually are celebrity chefs. You had a different kind of a business.
The celebrity chef is something that is more of the 90s phenomenon. When I started in New York back in 1983, the restaurateurs were the individual that would create the space and having chefs involved and together as a team effort creating this, what I like to call a great life experience, which is dining out in New York, one of the most challenging cities that you have. But I don't think it was because I was not a celebrity chef at the time. I just think it was the wrong thing to begin with. And that was a poor judgment on my side.
And you've learned your lesson.
Yeah, very, very.
Now you have one restaurant.
Yes, sir.
And how many have you had all together over the years?
The one created and built by me at one point were a total of 14 between New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Then with the acquisition of this company, I jumped to 23, 25. But basically there was this cancer that was inherited at that time.
Of course, nowadays it's going to be harder and harder to keep restaurants afloat anyway.
Very difficult.
But you think that, what do you see in the future? Do you see mostly moderately priced restaurants and a few of the really world famous expensive restaurants surviving while others go under?
But it's always a case of, you know, the survival of the fittest in this economical environment. I think that if you have a restaurant that has a good perceived value in terms of price point, quality of food and service, I think you basically going to be able to, weather the storms, survive and moving forward.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, is part of the problem sometimes rent? Because Tuscan Square, one of your restaurants, was in a high rent district.
Correct.
The prices weren't all that much higher than some of the other places.
No, Tuscan Square, when we were under renegotiating the extension of the lease, the lease was going to increase by almost 30%. And the same thing happened to Coco Pazzo as well. If it was going to happen at this renegotiation of the lease, maybe 6 months from now, it would have been a different reality. I think that, you know, the real estate market is the one who dominated the restaurant scene for the last 10, 15 years and imposed upon tenants and restaurateurs very stiff price. Probably the economy at that time dictated that. But I always thought that it was out of control because, you know what, when you start to think about numbers like $250 a foot in a restaurant, and you start to think about the price point you can charge, now you come and do a calculation that every chair has cost you a minimum of $100, $250 a day to keep going. How much can you charge to the customers?
You still
got to
buy the ingredients and pay all the staff and everything else. And just rent alone is $150 each chair?
But, you know, when you start to pay $250 a foot, mm-hmm. you start to be at the kind of price range.
So you got to turn those chairs over three or four times just to make anything close to a profit.
At one point, there was a disproportionate imbalance between what the reality of the restaurant economy and the reality of the real estate economy were. And I personally think that if there is someone to be blamed for that, is this race for opening more and more bank branches all over Manhattan, which they basically raised the price and made it very difficult for the restaurants to survive.
Of course, there are any number of restaurants that have opened in old, closed-down banks, so I guess it works both ways. My suggestion to somebody who wants to open up a restaurant is find a place where many restaurants have failed in the past and then convince the landlord to give you a 20-year lease. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble.
But that's basically the cycle that I went through. I mean, don't forget, operating in New York for 30 years, I basically went through at least four recessions and 9/11 as well. I opened Coco Pazzo I took Coco Pazzo from an existing restaurant, which was the now deceased Patrick Clark, which opened a great restaurant, but it was not in the right location. And the landlord agreed to give me a reduction on the rent. That was 1990.
And then you had a success, so he raised your rent again?
No, my original landlord sold the space to someone else, and someone else overpaid for the space, and then basically the economics of the restaurants in terms of rental went skyrocketing, and there was no way that, you know, a dinner-only restaurant, so 105 seats, can pay that kind of rent.
So is it simply rent that causes the problems? Sometimes it's going to be a change in conception. For example, you opened Il Cantinari.
Yeah.
Now Zagat describes it as an old traditional village place. It's an old village stalwart, it says. And now you don't own Il Cantinari.
No.
But still, you would think that it's still pretty much held on to the vision you had when you opened it 25 years ago. What was current then now is seen as old.
But there are two comments I would like to make to that one. One especially for the Zagat. I always take the Zagat with a little bit, you know, of limits of what they like to say. The number one is that...
Told me that you like Zagat for two reasons. They got the address right and they get the phone number right.
That's basically it. In Cantinori, my former partner, which is still owns it, Steve Jolis and Nicola Cozzonis, basically they own the building. And when you own the building where the restaurant is, you control your destiny. And Steve always being a very smart real estate man and did fantastic things for himself. And the fact that the restaurant is 25 years old, it should be a jubilation of happiness from everyone to really... in this world that everything lasts, is meant to last only for a few years, actually has such a longevity. It's something that, you know, I'm sure the customer of Cantinori still appreciate today. And that, you know, making these comments that, you know, everything that is now part of the last 3 or 4 years of the restaurant scene is not really of any interest, I think it's a fundamental flaw in the way Zagat, in the way the New York Times review restaurants, you know.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about reviews. We'll talk about how you went from being an actor to being in the kitchen. Most actors wind up serving the customers, at least between acting jobs. My guest is Pino Luongo, who's written with the help of Andrew Friedman, Dirty Dishes, a restaurateur's story of passion, pain, and pasta. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you for being here, and stay with us, okay? We're back with Pino Luongo, who has owned and operated some of the most successful and influential restaurants in New York, the Hamptons and Chicago. His first one, Il Cantinori, in 1983, and then several others, including Sapore di Mare, Le Madri, Coco Pazzo, currently the chef and owner of Centro Lire in New York City, and the author of a new memoir written with the help of Andrew Friedman called Dirty Dishes, a restaurateur's story of passion, pain, and pasta. It has a foreword by Anthony Bourdain, another man who has spilled the beans about the restaurant business in the past.
Yeah.
The book is published by Bloomsbury. I mentioned when we were going into the news that you had been pursuing a career as an actor in Rome before you came here. And I was wondering, don't most young actors work as waiters between roles? What got you interested in the cooking side of the restaurant business?
But even when I was living in Italy and working in theater, food was always my second passion. I remember having been in tours for 6-7 months a year all across the country. Every night after performance, our number one goal is to find a specialty type of place, a restaurant that, you know, can go from the Valle di Comacchio, going to have special eels stew in a certain way, or be in the north of Italy and going for lamb shank and braised cabbage, or be on the south and looking for fish. It was actually my true second passion. Then, when I came to New York, the language that was very much the tools of my making my living and earning my bread became totally useless because Italian was not a language that I could live with in New York. And
but why did you wind up coming here? This is a tough restaurant city, isn't it?
But I came to New York because I thought I was going to be here for 6 months. And the reason why is that when I was 18, I went for the medical draft for the military in 71. I applied for conscious objector. And they never called me within the 12-month terms. That was the law at that time. And they actually sent me a pin card on April 1980. I went to the lawyer, tried to really get these things resolved, but the lawyer told me, you know what, the only way you can stay out of uniforms is to leave Italy. So I was thinking to go either in France or London. He says, no, out of Europe. So and New York became my alternative because I was here in 1974 for a month. Which was a dismal experience because New York in 1974 was a different kind of city, kind of more dangerous and more problematic than what is today. But to go back to when I came to New York, when I realized that I was going to stay here for a longer period of time, my loneliness was determined by the fact that not speaking English, I was limited to my, you know, social life. And I eventually discovered that people appreciate me by my own cook, my skills in cooking and making meals. And so I choose the food as my line of communication.
Now, we've seen a major change in the way Italian food is presented in the city. When you arrived, there still were very few restaurants that we could call authentic, if that is a valid word. And definitely very few that even thought in terms of regional Italian.
That's correct.
And now New Yorkers are very sophisticated about that. We no longer have people coming back from Italy and saying, well, why can't we have restaurants like I ate at in Italy?
Right. But that was actually, I think, Del Cantinari was one of the early restaurants that really brought this change of mind. You're right. When I came to New York and I was looking for a job in the restaurants, I was choosing the restaurant by the menu outside. And when I started to go around all the strips of restaurant, 58th Street and Little Italy, I kind of found myself not really acquainted with what I was reading on the menu. And then eventually I ran into a restaurant in the village. When I start to read something that sounds more familiar, that's where I applied for a job. And that was Da Silvano. And I worked there for 2 years, from busboys to management, until I opened at Cantinori. But you know what? I remember the early days of Cantinori was a bench of guys like me and purveyors tried to bring stuff from Italy because we were looking for such a simple things that today is taken for granted, like arugula, like radicchio, like a whole fish, like those items were extra virgin olive oil.
They weren't available in 1983?
No. There was very little of this stuff available. Trevigiano. And I remember with the Mimmo, which now owns Buonitalia, he had a company at the time. It was flying over from Italy stuff, and there was a commitment from my bench of Italian restaurants to purchase his product so he can have a continuity. But how many times the stuff would arrive to the customs? 1 week, everything will go through, and the following week, no. For example, I remember a story that one time the invoice, when it was shipped to customs, says porcini mushrooms. It went through. The following week was boletus, and the guy threw everything into the incinerator. You know, I mean, those were the risks that we were taking on those days.
When you opened Le Madrid in 1989, you had a really unorthodox method for guaranteeing that the cuisine would be authentic. What did
right.
you do?
Pursuing my idea of regional food, I always came to the conclusion in Italy the regional food is very strong within the family environment. And so my mother, which is still a great example of what everything I learned from her, and the many mothers of the Italian family across the regions of Italy, were really the protagonists of this success. So I decided that I was going to open the restaurants and bring in four mothers and working with an American chef at the time, Alan Tardi, which was a very talented and very sensitive chef, which I always loved him for that. And basically, even though, you know, I was criticized because, you know, sometimes when you use a word to imply a concept, people just take the word for the exact meaning of it. And, of course, the mother that came, the only one who was a mother was Julia, but then there was Margherita, which was 19 years old, and there was Maria, which was a grandmother. And someone criticized me because, oh, what kind of mother are you talking about? But, you know, I always, you know, sometimes let some of these issues go by, even though sometimes the press irritates me.
In Europe, in Italy anyway, often women are in the kitchen.
Correct.
In France, it's the men who are in the kitchen. In
right.
Italy, the husband is usually in the front, and in France, it's the wife who's in the front.
Because I think that in France, what you eat at home and what you eat in the restaurant are two different things. And I think the restaurant cuisine in France was defined as a profession from skillful people over the centuries that turned into what the French cuisine is. In Italy, it was always the intent of everything that was home cooking, everything that was generated within the local environment, and still today preserve its value in that sense.
Do you think there are still some regions of Italy that are underrepresented here in New York?
Oh, yeah.
Friuli, for example?
Friuli is one, but Emilia-Romagna, for example, is still not really fully disclosed. Puglia, Sicily, as much as they think it is being represented, you know, it's
for a while, it was also, all Italian-American cooking came out of Sicilian cooking.
Yeah, but that
it?
Was a Sicilian cuisine that had 4,000 miles of ocean in between, and it was basically a cuisine of memories based on ingredients that they're not exactly the same ingredients that you can get back in there. I mean, most of the Italian-American cuisine is inspired by the Southern cuisine.
Do you agree with those people who say that New York may be the greatest restaurant city in the world? Because even though we don't have the best Italian restaurant or the best French restaurant or the best Chinese restaurant, we have higher quality of all the different cuisines that are represented than you can find anywhere else.
I absolutely believe so. And saying that we don't have the one single best restaurant of any kind of cuisine, it's irrelevant when you think about the enormous amount of wealth that the restaurant scene brings to New York City. And, you know, I travel in the past a lot everywhere in Europe and different parts of the world. And in the average Italian restaurant in New York, it's better than any average Italian restaurant in Italy. And many Italians would slap me around if they could hear me, but I stand for that because it is true. And the same thing happened for many different cuisines. So the standards of restaurant dining in New York is very high. And I think even though we might don't have the single best, we definitely have the best representation.
Would you like to see more restaurants opening up representing the various regions of Italy? I mean, I know Mexicans feel the same way. There are only three or four regions in Mexico that are represented in New York.
But I would love to, and also I would love to see coming through some more Italian, true Italian chef that come from the orthodox way of learning Italian cuisine, which is not only through the schools, but also through home cooking, regional research. Because it's funny that, you know, some of the most popular Italian restaurants in New York are not really run by Italian chef per se. They're all American chefs. And if you really want to be very picky and looking at the menu, you'll be surprised. There is some interpretation of Italian cuisine.
Well, Michael White is a very great chef as far as I'm concerned.
Michael White?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
It's as Italian as you can be, even though he's not Italian. No, he did spend a lot of time in Italy.
Yeah.
Has the fact that Frank Bruni at the Times lived in Italy for years meant that he's been more knowledgeable about the food than some of his predecessors?
But at least he's been exposed. He's been exposed to lots of Italian food for the years that he lived there. And I think that, you know, for the most part, when I read his reviews, he seems to be very knowledgeable of the Italian cuisine, even though, you know, sometimes I don't really agree with some of the overall opinions.
Can you ever agree 100% with any restaurant reviewer?
Yes.
if he likes what you like.
No, not necessarily. I just don't understand. You have a rating system, and when you have a rating system, for me the problem is the dichotomy about what is a restaurant review about. It's about only the food, it's about only the ambience, it's about the service, it's about the decor. Or, you know, sometimes I read certain review, restaurant, they get 3 stars, and you go over there, it's the most uncomfortable seatings in the planet. You know, I'm sitting on a piece of wood, and the place is cramped and it's not comfortable. Definitely hospitality is thrown out the window over there. And so my question is, what a reviewer is supposed to review for the restaurant? They have to also look into the investments that, you know, which is not only economical, it's cultural, it's in creativity, to create an ambient that is going to be a dining experience. And you should evaluate everything and not only the food.
Well, they do take things like the bathrooms and such into account.
Yeah, it happened to me.
Is that part of the pain? Because the subtitle of this book is A Restaurateur's Story of Passion, Pain, and Pasta. How much pain have you experienced?
A lot. A lot of pain. Mostly the pain comes from my own mistakes and not really be able to come to a conclusion with them, to a closure. And I think this book was my cathartic moment. I was able to just move on from my past.
Well, you've included some recipes. You've done that in the past with cookbooks, 5 cookbooks so far. But the recipes here tend to be rather basic because you're making some kind of point?
Because they are my favorite dishes.
Well, it's nice to have recipes in a cookbook. And if they are available through your publisher, we will put a link to them.
Absolutely.
Pino Luongo has written with the help of Andrew Friedman, Dirty Dishes, A Restaurateur's Story of Passion, Pain, and Pasta, and has a foreword by Anthony Bourdain. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Nice to be here, Leonard.